For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
That's right.
For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you.
That's right.
For the record, lab on me going all the way.
All the way.
For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste.
Stop calling.
For the record. For the record. For the. For the record. For the record. For the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
That's right.
Here we go again. Hope you're enjoying Season 7. Thank you to everybody who has tuned in, downloaded from all our platforms. I really, really hope that you're enjoying the wonderful guests we've been able to bring to you to date. Today is no different. An amazing guest that I think is going to bring so much value to the clink. And I really hope that everybody can take note of our conversation today. Her name is Dr. Mindy Sotiri. She's from Sydney and works around the justice system. Now, I'm not going to go too far into the whole specifics of Dr. Mindy. I'll let her actually deliver that. And Dr. Mindy, welcome to the Clink, Stories of Redemption. This is, how can I say it? It is an honor. I'm excited. And it's the first time out of 7 seasons that I've been able to have somebody with your passion and your drive and your initiative to want to see change within the justice system. Welcome to the Clink.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be part of this.
It's something that I think a lot of people will get value from, and we can clear up, I guess, a lot of questioning. Unfortunately, a lot of families have loved ones going into the system all over Australia. It is extremely hard for those to understand how it does work from the inside, what a traumatic experience it can be, and the highs and the lows of the system coming out, and how hard it is to be able to come home and not reoffend or not, you know, be put into a situation where you feel that there is no one out there and no resources and no help. You have to be passionate. What drove you to one, want to be involved in such an amazing process? And two, Doctor, where did it start for you?
Well, I guess it started when I was, you know, a teenager in a sense. I feel sort of a little embarrassed coming on your show, you know, because I hear so many amazing people with these incredible stories of redemption and these stories of the processes that they've been through, their experience of the system and how they've sort of moved beyond it. I have been fortunate enough to not myself personally be involved in going to prison. But when I was a teenager at university, you know, it was when I was, say, a teenager, when I was 18, I started studying social work. I had a big social justice bent, which was probably a product of a whole range of things to do with my own sort of family and upbringing. But when I was at university, I had a couple of lecturers who were very, I guess, passionate about the way that the prison system fails for so many people. And yeah, it was the first time for me that I'd ever really thought about it or known anything about prisons in Australia. And I managed to do my first student placement at Long Bay, actually, so back in the sort of mid-90s. So I was really, you know, I was young. And I guess from that experience, I haven't actually really done work outside of the justice system. I was so stunned by what I saw, not just at Long Bay, but at Mullewa or at Silverwater and a number of the other prisons that I ended up spending time in, and a number of the sort of, I guess, experiences that I saw just observing as somebody walking in the prison gates. And then the deeper I went into it and the more I learned about the prison system, primarily from the people that I was working with, the more shocked I was that, in fact, this was a normal or legitimate sort of response to crime. So I guess, there's a lot more to it, but I certainly, I guess, as a young uni student was really shocked that we chose to respond to harm or breaches of the social order in this way, which created more damage and created more trauma and certainly didn't make the community safer. And certainly, I guess, also, there's lots of people in prison that I guess I was really shocked were in there in the first place. I had no idea that so many people were there just waiting for their court dates, were there on remand. I had no idea that there were so many people with disabilities in prison, people with mental health conditions. So these are all still huge, big issues that I'm trying to tackle with now in this different role. But yeah, I spent the first 15 years of my sort of working life working primarily in service delivery, so as a social worker or a caseworker, working with people coming out of prison and advocating for people for whom it felt like the system was setting them up to fail.
I just want to ask, going back, for a lot of our listeners, and I like to do this just sort of dissect things a little bit because we do have so many people that like to listen to The Clink. Mm. Not everybody understands the system, the terms, and, you know, where they are and what they are. Long Bay, I was there early 90s. I was 18 and I went into the system, and it was a very dangerous place at that time in 9 Wing, 7 Wing, the RIC. The old SIP had just been shut down, and then they had the special purpose unit, I believe, in 10 Wing, straight across the circle, and then you had the chute to the medical and all that sort of stuff, Segro Yards on the backside here. Were you a part of the RIC more, or the MRC, or did you happen to be a part of the SIP before it shut down?
No, I wasn't. And when I was on placement there, I was actually with this unit that doesn't exist anymore. It was called something like the COSP, the Corrections Operational Support Unit, and it did a lot of different kinds of work across a lot of different, it was kind of like a problem solving unit. And I was, you know, I was just a student on placement, so I was doing odd things like helping people develop kind of pamphlets for sort of like working with people that were in prison around what their needs were, say around culturally appropriate sort of support, or, you know, sitting with welfare officers and working with them as people were talking to them about all of the different things that were coming up, needing to go to funerals, needing to get housing sort of sorted out on the outside. So it was a lot of different sort of connecting with lots of different people in different units. But I have to say, I've never worked in the prison, and I always think it's an important distinction. I'm very mindful that every time I visit a prison, and I used to visit them a lot to work with people before they got out of prison and then to pick people up on the day they were released from prison, but every single time I drive out of a prison car park, you know, I'm so relieved. You know, there's this sense of that the heaviness of what prison actually feels like, even as a visitor, is still overwhelming to me. And every single time I leave a prison, I'm sort of filled with this sense of relief, but also, you know, very mindful that for so many people, they, you know, including people in that are working in prisons in a way like that, what that culture is, what that loss of liberty is, that stuff that sort of, I guess, becomes normalized for people that go to prison and people that work in prison.
Yes.
I guess I'm still really shocked by it. You know, I've been doing it for more than 25 years and I'm still horrified by the oppressive nature of what it is that prisons feel like.
I have not been in the system since 2010, 2011. And just recently I was in custody for 2 months. In that 2 months, I was kept at a watch house for 24 hours a day, locked down for 10 days. And then I had to do nearly 21 days of 24-hour lockdown at the jail during the COVID. So it was 14 days. Mm-hmm. But if you happen to have a different cellmate that came in, then you had to restart, right? Now, your one-out cells have been turned into two-out cells. You have a mattress on the floor where the second person's head is underneath the toilet, basically. And I mean, you can't get up and urinate in the night or go to the toilet without basically being standing on the inmate on the floor. One, that's just totally inhumane and unhygienic. Look, you commit a crime, you do the time. I've done my time, I've done my jail, I've committed crimes in the past, and I'm not sitting here telling people shouldn't, whatever. But the way that the system is, and that's why are people coming out and being more against the system rather than wanting to break away from the system, is because of the way that they're treated in there. There's no outside communication. You can't talk, other than us now and someone like yourself being able to advocate, no one gives a fuck, my French. No one cares.
Yeah, and no one cares, but also people have no idea. People and I think that, you know, what you're saying is so true. And it's also, I think the thing that we also need to really remember is that we hear these stories and people go, oh my God, that's outrageous. But what people don't realize is that this is not an isolated story. This is what happened. You know, I used to hear these stories again and again and again with the people that I was working with over many years. And I continue to hear these stories. When in the 70s in New South Wales, there was a Royal Commission after there were massive riots at Bathurst Prison, you know, where people really...
Yes,
you
know, they burn it down.
They burn it down.
Well aware of that one.
And one of the things in the Nagel Royal Commission, one of the things that Nagel said, and it's really stuck with me, is something that I think we need to get really clear about, and that is that people are sent to prison as punishment, not for punishment. We often get the two confused, but the reality is that loss of liberty is a really serious punishment. People get a little glimpse of this during COVID when we can't go to the pub or we can't go to a coffee shop.
I had to laugh at this.
Of course you did. Every single person.
Comparing, going, oh, it's like being in jail. And
that's
I'm thinking,
right.
For goodness sake, just stop.
Exactly.
Just
but that's
stop.
Right, because every single person that's been to prison or, in fact, has had anything to do with prisons just went, of course, it's nothing like being in prison. But what it is that people got a glimpse into is what it feels like just in the smallest way to have loss of liberty, to not be able to do the things that you want to do. Now, there are prisons in other places in the world which do not punish in the way that Australian prisons punish.
Europe have got an amazing system, and it is a reward system that works. Their rate of comeback, it's in some minuscule percent.
Their prisons in Scandinavia, in Sweden, in Norway, in Denmark, yep. There are reductions in the numbers of people going to prison. They are closing down prisons. But what I guess that shows us is that, and what I'm sure, you know, you might have experienced this too, like a lot of people that I've worked with go, oh, you know, look, there was a really good unit at Long Bay. Narrenura is one of the places where people really...
That was the drug unit.
Yeah, and you know, it was a therapeutic unit and everybody who worked there wanted to be there and people did really well. It's no longer there. We can see these little pockets of things where you go, oh, okay, maybe we could do things a bit differently. Small groups of people together, not so much, you know, where there's actually a personal relationship between the officers and the people inside that is not adversarial. Imagine a system where you didn't have to wear uniforms. Like, that's what happens in some prisons overseas.
That's right. They wear their own clothes.
Yeah. Where you actually retain an identity outside of just your MIN number or, you know, outside of being a crim or outside of being an inmate, where you're actually recognised in terms of being a dad or being a husband or being a forklift driver or being, you know, or studying or whatever it is. At the moment, we've got this system that completely dehumanises people in lots of subtle ways, not giving people a Panadol when they've got a bloody headache. I mean, come on, like, actually, what's that about?
You can't. You're not being heard in there today. You are not being heard in there. And I can tell you this. I know in the Queensland system, you've got a whole wing. The screws sit behind a glass box. There's like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of them. They don't give a shit. One looks at a camera. The rest of them are all talking crap and they're on the internet looking at whatever. You knock on there and say, oh, Chief, can I get a slip for me bio? Poor Chief, can I ask for a medical form? Oh, yeah, come back later. I'm too busy. You're not fucking busy. I can see you're not. There is zero care factor. The only time that they'll come into that wing, if there's an emergency, if it kicks off, or it's a medical. Outside of that, it's run by the inmate. So you've got no access to anything.
Yeah. And I guess that, I mean, one of the things that I think about, because obviously, you know, there's good people that work in prison, same as everywhere. You know, there's good people within the system and there's good people trying to...
And we're not here to belittle anybody that does work in the system, because I know there's a lot of screws out there that do listen to the clink and a lot of police and so on.
Oh,
so,
and look, on our group of patrons for the Justice Reform Initiative, we've got former corrections commissioners. So it's like there are people in there that want the system to be better. But I think that what we've got to look at is so much of the stuff that happens that is really inhumane, or that you know, which when the system really breaks down is often a result of overcrowding, and often a result of, you know, there not being the staff sort of required to kind of be able to have people out of their cells for the hours that people should be, and so on. So we actually need to look at, why is that? Like, why have we got so many people going into our prisons in Australia when we know that, say, over the last 10 years, we are notorious sort of internationally for our over-incarceration. The Productivity Commission found in their last report that there are only two countries in the world that are incarcerating at a rate faster than Australia.
Third world, wouldn't it? You know, Salvador or something like that.
You know
that.
Who it is? It's Colombia and Turkey.
Yeah,
so, you know, so between 2003 and 2018, we are the third fastest incarcerator in the world. Now, if we were having a massive crime wave, maybe that would make sense. But the reality is that we are incarcerating at a time when there is no increase in crime, when crime, in fact, in almost all of the major categories is either stable or, in fact, decreasing.
What about visits? Yeah. And this is something that I think is huge. Everyone's going to have their own opinion here, and everybody's entitled to that, but you know it because of what you do. There's men and women that are incarcerated at the moment that haven't touched or felt a loved one in over 18 months.
Yeah.
If you're lucky enough that they approve your partner, male or female, or your children, for you to have a 1 hour video conversation, or whatever you call it, a video visit, if you're lucky. Because I don't know how many times I've seen my cellmate go out and be told it's got cancelled, while his wife had driven 2 hours to see him. At one stage, she was denied, not for any, totally just legitimately said, no, we don't have staff. He was booked in to go to Videolink to have his video visit. No, sorry, we don't have the staff for it.
Yeah.
So it's as quick as that. Someone can say, sorry, and no one really cares about the loved one outside, the children.
Yeah.
You know, for example, you physically cannot, I know that they're doing this because of the drugs and all this sort of stuff. And there's some twisted people out there that put drugs in their kids' nappies and do the shit. I've got no respect for them whatsoever. You just do not do that shit. But it has now changed it so that, you know, you must sit within a distance. You physically can't touch a loved one.
Mm.
And that, in connection for a man that's in jail, whether it be with the children or a partner, is such a vital moment of that week, you know, for that short time, just to have that connection, that feeling of another human that you love you.
Yeah.
It's all gone. It doesn't exist.
Mm.
Now, these are more negatives added into an absolute hostile environment. I'll be very honest. I don't think that I would have ever asked my wife to bring my children into the system. And even if that opportunity arose, I just don't feel that they deserve to be humiliated and belittled and treated in a way that would be traumatizing, as much as it'd be painful for me not to see them. And it is for so many men. What I'm getting at then, so you then flick a switch, you become emotionless. You have to detach from your heart. You have to detach from your emotional connection to your loved ones, because it makes you vulnerable. You know, people see that as a weakness. So therefore, you have to just go, you know what, whatever, that's it. No visits. I'm in jail. I'm in mindset of jail. And that's how it is. How do you then come out of a long-term situation, or, you know, a year or 2 or 3 years? I'm not talking about a couple of months. Yes, okay, it can be traumatic for someone, but how does one then come out wanting and knowing and being able to alter that mindset to successfully achieve? And yes, there are people that have done it in Kendall, but there should be so many more that get through it.
That's
but
right.
It's easy to just go, fuck it, I'm going back in.
Yeah, and look, I mean, I remember very clearly one of the first people that I worked with, and I was just a little baby social worker, and I thought he was doing great. You know, he was sort of, I thought that, you know, I'd found, he'd sort of got a place to live, and he was really stoked about that, and he sort of was doing all the counselling that his parole required him to do, and he was sort of ticking all the boxes. And I remember getting to work and hearing that he'd he'd broken into a car and the alarm of the car had gone off, and he'd just stayed in there waiting for the cops to come and get him. And when I went to visit him in prison, and he was very ashamed to he hadn't expected me to come into prison. He'd already switched into the mode that he needed to be in when I went to see him. And I guess that I was just sort of like, what happened, you know? And he was unbelievably lonely, just unbelievably lonely. And it was all too difficult. Like, he couldn't, you know, because he hadn't had the sort of connections that he needed when he'd done his time in prison. He was really trying to do it all on his own with, you know, some little like social worker kind of trying to help him, but it's not enough, you know. So I think that what I keep on saying to people is, imagine if that rather than it being, you know, just an exception, you know, you hear all the time these stories of people that have, you know, managed to do education or managed to get a job or managed to sort of get their drug and alcohol treatment and managed to get it all sort of ticked off. But it's not, it doesn't operate in any way systemically. So more often than not, people don't have access to programs. They don't have access to housing. They don't have access to mental health support. They don't have access to drug and alcohol treatment. They don't have access to disability support. Now, all of these things, so what we end up doing is managing people in criminal justice system settings rather than actually providing the support and care and love and connection that all of us require in the community. Some of us have been lucky to have been born into a situation where that stuff happens organically, but that is just not the case for lots of people. And so when that's not the case, you have to build something different and you have to show people that there are different ways of doing things. But we just don't do it. And this is, I mean, I'm optimistic because I think that, you know, we can actually shift the way that the community thinks about imprisonment, but more importantly, and related to that, we need to sort of shift the way that politicians use imprisonment as a kind of political tool to gain votes, to seem to be tough on crime, because it shouldn't just be a matter of luck in terms of getting access to programs. We shouldn't be managing people in prison just because they happen to be poor and they happen to be born into a particular set of circumstances and they happen to have contact with the police when they're a kid and they happen to, you know, that is not how we should be building things. And in fact, it's cheaper and much more effective in terms of building community safety if you actually build programs and interventions that are nothing to do with the justice system, that are actually all about developing somebody's potential the way that all of us actually require. So I guess the reason I say that I'm hopeful, and because obviously we can, you know, we could spend many, many hours talking about all of the things that are wrong with the system, and you know it in your bones, and I know it in, you know, from all the research and all of the work that I've done. Like, it is so clear that the system is broken, that jail doesn't work. But the reason why I think that we can actually change this is because there's a couple of things, but I think that in Australia for the first time we have the patrons of the Justice Reform Initiative include two former Governor Generals of Australia, Sir William Dean and Dame Quentin Bryce. So people that are not necessarily, you know, they're not radical human beings, they're very establishment. We have people from all sides of politics that have signed up to be patrons. We've got 120 patrons, former High Court judges, former Chief Magistrates, we've got Children's Commissioners. These are all people that are very much part of the system, that are all saying the same thing, corrections commissioners, police commissioners, that are all saying prison does not work. Now,
Doctor, we've got this. So you've got the support. Why can we not make waves and make change?
I think, and this is not to say there haven't been people doing amazing work before now, we've got a long way to go in that. We've got a lot of educating the community to go. And while people still think that prison works to rehabilitate, to deter, to make the community safer, it's going to be very hard to get politicians to be brave enough to actually say, actually, we're not going to have an election that's all about who can be toughest on crime. We're actually going to try and compete to see who can be the most sensible at reducing crime by putting the, you know, the best programs in place. But there is no way that we can keep going doing what we're doing, spending the money that we're spending, $5.2 billion a year just on the operation of prisons, many billions more on building more, without actually holding politicians to account for it. And I think from what I've observed, and we're a new organisation where I've only been there a year and a half, you know, so it's yeah. a brand, we're building something. But I guess that what I would do is encourage your listeners to be part of this movement, of the Jailing is Failing movement. Sign the petitions on the website, you know, donate, get people engaged. But we need so many more people behind us. And I feel like there's a little bit of a movement already with the work that you're doing, with the work that others are doing with different kinds of podcasts and social yeah. media, where they're, you know, just slowly we're starting to get the word out that this is, we've got a really broken system and there's a way of doing things differently that actually doesn't need any more research. We know what needs to happen. We That's just need right. the, we need the political will to make it happen.
People don't deserve to be treated in the manner that they're treated once they're behind those walls.
That's right.
And it's yeah. even the families on the outside, the abuse that they cop from the inside, not talking about from the inmates, but from the officers, the screws, the correctional officers, and how they're treated, you know, for trying to ring up and seek information about their loved ones, trying to organise a visit, trying to send money in to support them for buy-ups. There's nothing. And how helpless to then they feel out here, you know, adding more pressure to the family already. You know, there's enough there that there's an independent parent raising the children, or children have gone into care because the parents are locked up, both mum and dad, whatever it might be. There's nothing positive about it, and it creates such bitterness within one that therefore a lot of people come out with so much more hatred, negativity, aggression, and just purely want to rebel because of what they had done to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the mindset. How do we change it? How do we better the majority instead of looking at the minority and saying, okay, well, we're getting numbers of success through the minority. Sorry, but that just sets a bit of a precedent to show that we can do things. We can make change.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think
we need to make it a majority.
Yeah, that's right. It can't just be a matter of luck if you happen to get a program. It has to be available to everybody. There's a couple of things there. One is that, I mean, I think the families that are supporting people inside are such critical voices. They often talk about feeling like they're doing a sentence at the same time as their loved ones are. And often they don't. They feel a shame and a stigma that they can't talk about it. You know, so there's all of that stuff that comes along with it. So we need to actually, and you know, they've done, the kids, nobody's done anything wrong. Like they're just, you know, they're just.
Even to the point, Doctor, when it's a public interest, like for example, mine's a public interest matter because it's all been all over the media. It's constantly, no matter what move, you know. They're talking about this. They talk about it every time I go to court. My kids are teenagers. You know what I mean? They're on the internet. They've got peers around them. Their parents know us. We're involved in community activities, sporting groups. You know, I'm walking around with an anklet that should have been taken off me by now, and there's no reason in the world why it should be on there. And I won't get into the but I'd love to talk to you further offline about that. But, you know, it's humiliating. I'm not a threat to the community. There's no breaches. I've had no problems with anything. My Supreme Court... The only reason why I went on there was because I was wanting to better my situation through employment to seek to be able to, you know, have enough money to provide for my family and then be able to have enough money to a defence. So to do that, I couldn't report every day. So they put it on me. Then we went back on Thursday to have it removed because that wasn't available anymore because of the time that the courts took. Fair enough. That's not the company's problem. I'm employed again. But my employment doesn't need me to have this on.
Yeah.
You know, I'm happy to report every day. I'm happy to live by curfew. The Crown laughs at me and goes, nah, we don't see any grounds for him to have it removed. Like, are you kidding me? You know, and I'm one of many. I'm just using my own personal experience, you know. Now, let's put that into perspective. I'm actively out with my children all the time. I'm in the public, in the community. You know, it's not fair. They need to see their dad or walk around me holding my daughter's hand, you know, whilst I've got a big clunk on my ankle.
Yeah.
And then people judging them or, you know, sending them messages through social media, your dad's this, your dad's that, you know, blah, blah, blah. No one deserves that.
No, they don't.
You know, but this is the realities of, Doctor, of what I have to live with daily and so many others out there that are in the same position.
Yeah. So we need to, I mean, there's so many, because I'm always like, you know, there's so many things that we need to change. Like there's so many bits and sometimes it can feel a bit overwhelming. So, you know, we need to change bail legislation. We need to raise the age of criminal responsibility. We need access to housing. We need access to all these programs. But the way that I see it, like the big piece of work that, again, I think is just so important. I don't know, you know, I don't know how we can sort of get the change without this bit is that we need for people, like, it's like all of these kind of bits, like trying to change things like the unfair sort of electronic monitoring or unfair home detention sort of rules or setting people up to fail with the way that they're released and so on. All of those things, it's like we can kind of, it's like running or swimming against a tide, and the tide is this kind of idea that prison is a legitimate and sensible response to crime and a legitimate way to protect the community. That's what we need to turn around. We need to turn around that thinking on all levels. So every conversation that I have with people, and it doesn't matter who they are, I will talk to absolutely everybody, and we need to talk to people that think that everybody should just rot in jail. We need to talk to victims groups. We need to talk to people that Absolutely. Are members of business chambers or members of political parties that have always been really tough on crime. Because actually, again, it doesn't matter in a way what your values are. I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, I want to be friends with everybody that's part of this movement, but it doesn't matter. As long as you can understand just in a really practical way why ensuring that people are in prison or ensuring people that are caught up in the justice system in whatever way are treated in such a way that they are not going to go on and do more crime or, like you said, get more and more angry or more and more rebellious. As long as you can see practically why it makes sense to actually put things in place so that people have the opportunity to be punished but not to become worse as a consequence of that, then you can join this movement. You don't have to be a kind of raving lefty. You don't have to have done time in prison to understand it. You just have to go, do we want a safer community? And if yes, what are the best ways of achieving that? And what we know with no doubt is that prison isn't it. Yeah.
No, and don't create a boiler room.
Yeah.
And this is what every – I don't care where you are in Australia. Mm. Go to any jail. Every wing – is an absolute boiler room waiting to just explode.
Yeah.
There is no good in it.
Mm. We need as many people to know this, that this is the reality. And it's not to, again, it doesn't have to be all about criticizing corrections, although, you know, like, you know, that's part of it, but it's just like, this is just the reality. This is what prison's like. There's no denying it. Like, it's not like this is sort of a big secret, but people just don't know about it. You know, like when we did our research, 75% of people in Australia, and we did 2,500 surveys across Australia, 75% of people had never had any contact with the justice system, hadn't even called the police as being a victim of crime or to report anything. So, you know, it's not me being sort of judgmental. People just people rate themselves as having a very low understanding of what happens. But
People don't want to know. It's jail. Yeah, it's dirty. It's a dirty word.
That's right. That's right. Because
we disconnect. We do not associate.
That's right. But actually, what I've also seen happen, and I've seen this happen politically quite a lot, is that when people meet somebody who has been to prison, if they've never met somebody that's been to prison before, and you introduce them to somebody and they have a conversation, the same thing happens as what happens with all of us when we've got another human in front of us and we're having a cup of tea and we're talking about our kids or we're talking about the weather or we're talking about whatever, and you start going, okay, this person, and this is exactly what happened to me when I was really young and went into prisons. I couldn't believe it. I'd be having cups of tea with people and thinking, hang on, this isn't what I had in my head that people in prison were going to be like. But not everybody has that opportunity. We, like my job, is largely about giving people that opportunity to understand that people that go to prison are no different from anybody else in the community, no different from me, were it not for a set of circumstances in which they have found themselves. So this idea, you know, and I genuinely believe that. I know that people make bad decisions, but I also know that in the eastern suburbs of Sydney there are people taking huge amounts of drugs and never going to prison, you know. So
I love your way.
So it's not like...
You know what, Doctor, I had this conversation the other day. If I had the money to provide a solid legal defence, I wouldn't be in a position that I'm in at the moment.
Yeah.
It's not often you see a wealthy person getting caught and put... There are some out there, and I've met some over the years that get caught up in some big things, but that's justifiable, whether it be fraud or drugs or whatever, and we're talking big, big. But the average person with money or family that support them, there's no job.
No, that's right. Or
they go down to Coomera and they hang out with the other coppers and the screws and pedophiles that all live in one environment where it's a very soft and nice little place. And
yeah, you know. But I mean, it's sort of, in some ways it's funny because we know that there's this disparity. But I often also think, you know, if you're a kid and you happen to be born with a disability and you are, say, you know, you're born into a rich suburb, chances are that that disability is going to be identified by, you know, maybe people at your childcare or by your family, and supports will be kind of wrapped around you, and your family may well advocate for you to get access to proper treatment and stuff, and, you know, and it's treated as a disability. But if you're a kid and you're born into a circumstance where you don't have access, or your family doesn't have resources and access to services, if you're born outside of, say, a metropolitan area, if you're born into a poor community, then the chances are that instead of that disability ever being recognised, your first contact and your first acknowledgement of that disability will be when you're in juvenile justice. Like, that is, you know, that is honestly how those, and there's been, again, all this, this is not just me observing stuff. There's really substantial research around life courses for people from different demographics. So it's not just around what does or doesn't happen in corrections. It's around what does and doesn't happen in the community before people even get to that point. So I think, you know, the Justice Reform Initiative is saying, look, we want to build communities in which disadvantage is not met with a justice system response. And that's actually what it's all about. We need to build a different kind of system where, rather than people getting punished for who they are, they're actually able to have the option. It's not to say we don't need prisons. We probably do. But
look, there's no two ways about it. There's some shit people in this world. Let's not beat around the bush. Like, you can be an advocate for this, you know, on a neutral ground. But reality is there is a need for this, for a system that accommodates certain styles of people. You know, that's just, this is what it is. The majority, if we speak on a majority as a minority, the majority of people that are in the system, they're not all bad people. You know, they've made bad choices. A lot of them are product of their environment. I'm not here to justify myself or anybody else that's been incarcerated. I made choices. I did the wrong things at times. But I was also, too, a sexually abused child that came through the system. I had nothing. I was on the streets. I had to survive. And surviving for me, growing up in the era that I did, in the lower demographic of the Housing Commission, all that sort of stuff, you know, constantly being abused and sexually abused. And, mate, it was just be the baddest you could be, because it actually stopped people from wanting to attack you. Oh, jails are full of people like that, and it's a sad. It is sad because, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. And I feel with what you do, and if we can make change and we can have the right people there to create a better way, then we've got to see a change in the system. You've got to start to see lesser reoffending, lesser drug use, more support, people feeling that they're just... People come out with no choice. And everybody says, oh, you've all got choices. But hang on. $300 check, when you come out of jail with nothing, no accommodation, no clothes, no one to support, why do you not think that people take the $300 and stick it straight up their arm? Because they don't have to deal with the reality then, and they know what they know best, and that's to be off their head, stone, and next minute they're in that vital, you know, way of life where for them it's just the norm. So they don't get that opportunity to break that cycle.
That's right. And it has to change. And we can see it changing in little pockets, you know. We can see the services that do exist that do amazing work with tiny numbers of people. But, you know...
Are you happy, Doctor, with what you're seeing?
Oh, God, not yet. We need much more. I mean, we need to turn things around so dramatically. We have 43,000 people in prison across Australia. A third of them are on remand, haven't even been found guilty, haven't been sentenced.
And what's the average remand? 12 to 14 months or something, isn't it?
I don't know, actually. It's really different.
I know blokes that have been sitting for years.
Yeah, it's different in different jurisdictions. We've got 60% of people in there because they're of their drug and alcohol use. We've got, you know, close to 70% of people in there with mental health conditions. We've got about 10% in there with cognitive impairments. I mean, there is so much to change. But I do think it's entirely possible. And I do think that we can look overseas, not just to the United States where they've had that big rhetorical shift, but we can look at different countries and go, oh, hang on, they're not imprisoning in the same ways that we are. There's not this horrendous and sort of conflicted relationship between the people that go to prison and the people that work in prisons. There's not this sort of this extra layer of punishment on top of the loss of liberty. There are so many ways to do things differently. Imagine if police had pre-charge diversion available for every single kid that they came into contact with, that there was a youth worker that they could call rather than, you know, having to lock them up in the cells. Imagine if there was sort of the same for when the police are called out, well, and somebody's having a mental health episode and there was a mental health worker. Imagine the same with drug and alcohol treatment.
I get that. But I'm also going to throw the spanner in the works here, because at the moment, up here on, you know, in Queensland and the Gold Coast, our youth crime rate is absolutely at its worst ever.
Yeah.
And it is coming down to the lack of, I guess, how do I put this without sounding... Their bail conditions are so laxed.
Yeah.
And the age of, ownership to what that they're doing, and the young kids that they're getting, 11 and 12, stealing these prestige cars, sneaking into houses. Every night it's police chases, it's kids crashing cars, people in hospital. You know, there is lives that have been lost. There'll be many more. Why is that? You know, why are we not bringing it back to a manageable level within the juvenile justice system up here? Well, it's because of the way it's structured. Do I feel that, you know, sometimes that, you know, kids may need to be, well, men as well, women, probably bail refused sometimes is good for them, especially if they're, you know, extremely addicted to ice, which is most of the problems up here. Given bail, they're only going to go get high again and do the same thing again. And what, next time they might actually kill an innocent person? Mm-hmm. See, things like that, I feel that there needs to be some sort of structure.
Absolutely. But it's not, I mean, I think the thing is that our starting point has to be, look, this current system isn't working.
No.
Which is not to say that we've sorted out what the alternative system looks like, but it means that we have to. It's the tap on the shoulder to go, we know that locking kids up doesn't make a difference at all in terms of community safety, no, except for a very short period of time when they're actually incarcerated. And we know, in fact, it puts people on a path to adult sort of criminal justice system. So what might it look like? Like, what, you know, we need to use our imaginations with this stuff. And again, there's really good models that operate at a really small scale. Look in New Zealand, there's very few kids that are going into detention in New Zealand because of pre-charge diversion, because of the way that young people are connected with other services, with communities and with culture.
Can you just elaborate, Dr. Forrest, for those that probably wouldn't understand that pre-charge diversion?
Well, so if a cop comes, like, you know, if a kid is acting out and a cop sort of sees them acting out, and, you know, say they're drunk or they're, you know, they're being an idiot or they're being loud, they're not necessarily in the middle of committing a really violent crime, but they're out and about. Often what happens is that ends up escalating. The kid will end up swearing at the police officer, or they'll end up being some sort of interaction that will mean that rather than it just...
That
they end up getting charged. I mean, that happens with adults all the time as well. But, you know...
You're a public nuisance or whatever.
Exactly. Public order stuff.
It's enough to cause problems.
So yeah. rather than at every point in the justice system, if we thought this should be an opportunity to actually springboard or trampoline somebody out of the justice system. So pre-charge diversion just means that police have the discretion, rather than to charge somebody, to call somebody. You know, if there's a service, for instance, a 24-hour youth service that's got a bunch of properties around the place that are 24 hours that kids can go to say, sleep off their booze if they're really drunk and they're not able
like
to go home because home's not safe, where there are other places that are not run by juvenile justice officers or corrections officers, that are run by people that are actually skilled at working with kids that are usually pretty distressed, actually, you know, that have a lot of stuff going on, and that, you know, that are not there to punish them, that are there to genuinely say, look, you know, why don't you come here and spend some time here, and then you can go home tomorrow, or we can take you to school in the morning, or whatever it is. So again, it's not very complicated. It's the same as with courts. Like, rather than the court being the place where the determination is made that you go directly to prison, what if there were sort of things like access? Like, what if you were sentenced to drug and alcohol treatment? What if you were sentenced to mental health? I mean, that stuff happens, but it's so small and there's lots of exclusionary sort of options. So, and again, at the point
you generally only get that one shot at or something,
that's
isn't
right,
it?
You, and you have to plead guilty, and, you know, there's lots of things.
That's right. There's a whole line of restrictions that must take place. So you technically don't get a choice to express yourself, or it's got to be a certain way by what they want you to conform to have that opportunity. And then if it doesn't, you go back to jail anyway.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I guess that what we're saying is that there are those points, like whether it's the police kind of, you know, working with mental health services or drug and alcohol workers or youth workers, whether it's the courts sort of sentencing people to things that are not to do with prison, or in fact, as happens in some youth courts, you know, magistrates and sort of saying, look, I'm not going to make a decision about sentencing for 6 weeks. I need all of this stuff to come into place, you know, in this 6 weeks, and then let's look at it again.
Don't pre-sentence reports and stuff like that.
Yeah, like, why isn't that stuff systematised so that rather than whacking everybody into prison on remand, which is what most kids are. Yeah, exactly. So that,
back in the days, I remember Bajura Court as a juvenile, you very rarely, unless you really made a big bad mistake, but even then they'd ask for a pre-sentence report before delivering your sentence. And it was massively taken into consideration, the circumstances, the lifestyle, why you were committing the offences, and, you know, what prospects of rehabilitation that you had.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
I don't see that anymore.
No, that's right.
Dr. Mindy Sotiri. Sotiri, have I got it right?
Yeah, that's perfect.
I have thoroughly enjoyed having you on The Clink, and I really hope that our listeners have finally had a bit of insight to what the realism is behind Four Walls. Look, I would love to talk to you further down the track. I know that you are a very, very busy woman, and for your time, we are forever grateful. If there could be one verse, paragraph, or sentence that you could leave our listeners in a positive way, for someone that might be struggling out there or not understanding, what would you say, Doctor, to them?
I would say that jailing is failing, that there are ways to build a different kind of justice system that doesn't punish people that are disadvantaged and that genuinely gives people the opportunity to build the lives that everybody should have the opportunity to build. I would say that for people that are in the system, that have managed to survive the system and that are managing to survive on the outside, I am in awe of the work that you do. That includes you, Brent. I really am. I know from the outside how much it takes to turn things around, and I know how difficult it is to do that without the sort of supports in place. I guess that I want people to know also that there are many, many people and a growing number of people in Australia that really understand that prison isn't the answer, that it doesn't work to rehabilitate, that it doesn't work to deter, and that we need to do better as a community, that we need to build different kinds of systems. And it's not just people that are working in prisons or working with people on release. It includes governor generals, it includes corrections commissioners, it includes police commissioners, it includes many former members of the judiciary, it includes amazing Aboriginal leaders. There is a growing group of people that understand jailing is failing, and I guess that I would just urge people to lend their voices, especially those people that have lived experience, lend your voices to this, and we need to get out and tell as many people in the community as we can, because we need to really change the way that people understand imprisonment.
Doctor, thank you. And for anybody that wants to contact you, could you please leave us with your details? How can someone reach out, contact and support your wonderful organisation and your movement?
Absolutely. If you look on the website, you can either type in jailing is failing or you can type in Justice Reform Initiative and you'll come up with our website. And then you can sign up to be a supporter. You'll get letters. There's phone numbers on there that you can call if you've got lived experience and you want to tell your story. And then there's a place to donate if you're rich and you want to get rid of some cash. But yeah, please sort of stay connected and you know, you can also kind of contact me directly kind of through the website as well. So very available for chatting with people.
Love the time we've spent together, Doctor. Amazing insight. Thank you so much. We will talk again down the track. Would love to hear how the progression has gone, and you're always welcome here on The Clink as a platform to be able to get your word out there. Guys, there you have it. A wonderful chat. I hope you enjoyed it. This is The Clink, Stories of Redemption.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
That's right.
For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you.
That's right.
For the record, lab on me going all the way.
All the way.
For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste.
Stop calling.
For the record. For the record. Yeah. For the record. For the record. For the record.